Chapter 30. Cold, Fat Raindrops. The day dawned cold, with gray clouds that obscured the rising sun, and winds off the sea of storms that rattled loose panes of glass in the window casements. In stories, not the sort of day for grand rescues and escapes, it was a day for murders. Not a pleasant thought when you were hoping to live past another dawn, but the plan was simple. Now that he had a Shanchen blood to use, nothing could possibly go wrong. Matt tried very hard to convince himself of that. Lopin brought him breakfast, bread and ham and some hard yellow cheese, while he dressed. Narim was folding a few last pieces of clothing that were to go to the inn, including some of the shirts Thailand had had made. They were good shirts, after all, and Narim claimed he could do something about the lace, though as usual he made it sound as if he were offering to sew a shroud. The lugubrious, gray-haired little fellow was handy with a needle, as Matt knew well. He had sewn up enough of Matt's wounds. "Narim and I will take Oliver out by the refuse gate at the rear of the palace," Lopin recited with exaggerated patience, his hands clasped at his waist. Servants in a palace seldom missed meals, and his dark Tyran coat fit more tightly than ever over his round belly. For that matter, the bottom of the coat did not appear to flare as much as it once had. "There is never anyone there except the guards until the refuse cart leaves in the afternoon, and they are accustomed to us taking my lord's things out that way, so they won't remark us. At the Wandering Woman, we will secure my lord's gold and the rest of my lord's garments, and Metwin, Fergin, and Gorderon will meet us with the horses. We and the Red Arms will then take young Oliver through the Dal Ira gate at mid-afternoon. I have the lottery tokens for the horses, including both pack animals, in my pocket, my lord. There is an abandoned stable on the Great North Road about a mile north of the Circuit of Heaven, where we will wait until we see my lord. I trust I have my lord's instructions correctly." Matt swallowed the last of the cheese and dusted his hands. "You think I'm making you go over it too often?" he said, shrugging into his coat. A plain, dark green coat. A man wanted to be plain while about business like today's. "I want to make sure you have it by heart. Remember, if you don't see me before sunrise tomorrow, you keep moving until you find Talmanis and the band." The alarm would go up with the morning inspection of the kennels, and if he was not out of the city before that, he expected to learn whether his luck ran to stopping a headsman's axe. He had been told that he was fated to die and live again, a prophecy or near enough one, but he was pretty sure that had already happened. "Of course, my lord," Lopin said blandly. "It will be as my lord commands."
"Certainly, my lord," Narim murmured, funereal as ever. "My lord commands, and we obey."
Matt suspected they were lying, but 2 or 3 days waiting would not hurt them, and by that time they would have to see he was not coming. Metwin and the other 2 soldiers would convince them if need be. Those 3 might follow Matt Cawthon, but they were not fool enough to stretch their necks on the chopping block if his head had already fallen. For some reason, he was not as sure of Lopin and Narim. Oliver was not as upset over leaving Rizal as Matt had feared he would be. He brought the subject up while he was helping the boy bundle his belongings to be carried over to the inn. All of Oliver's things were laid out neatly on the narrow bed in what had been the sulking room, a small sitting room, when the apartment had been Matt's. "She's getting married, Matt," Oliver said patiently, as though explaining to someone who didn't see the obvious. Popping open a narrow little carved box Rizal had given him, just long enough to make sure his red hawk's feather was safe, he snapped it shut and tucked it into the leather scrip he would be carrying on his shoulder. He was as careful of the feather as he had been of the purse holding 20 gold crowns and a fistful of silver. "I don't think her husband would like her to keep teaching me to read. I would not if I were her husband." "Oh," Matt said. Rizal had worked quickly once she made her mind up. Her marriage to Banner General Yamada had been announced publicly yesterday and was to take place tomorrow, though by custom there was usually a wait of months between. Yamada might be a good general,
Matt did not know, but he had never stood a chance against Rizel and that marvelous bosom. Today they were looking at a vineyard in the Rhiannon Hills that the groom was buying for her wedding gift.
"I just thought you might want to, I don't know, take her with us or something."
"I am not a child, Matt," Ulver said dryly.
Folding the linen cloth back around his striped turtle shell, he added that to the scrip.
"You will play snakes and foxes with me, won't you? Rizel enjoys playing, and you never have time anymore."
Despite the clothes Matt was bundling up in a cloak that would go into a pack hamper, the boy had a spare pair of breeches and some clean shirts and stockings in the scrip, too. And the game of snakes and foxes his dead father had made for him. You were less likely to lose what you kept on your person, and Ulver had already lost more in his 10 years than most people did in a lifetime. But he still believed you could win at snakes and foxes without breaking the rules, too.
"I will," Matt promised.
He would if he managed to make it out of the city. He was certainly breaking enough rules to deserve to win.
"You just take care of Wind till I get there."
Ulver grinned widely, and for him that was very wide indeed. The boy loved that leggy gray gelding almost as much as he did snakes and foxes. Unfortunately, Beslin was another who seemed to think you could win at snakes and foxes.
"Tonight," he growled, stalking up and down in front of the fireplace in Tylin's sitting room. The slender man's eyes were cold enough to take away the warmth of the blaze, and his hands were clasped behind his back as if to keep them from the hilt of his narrow-bladed sword.
The jeweled cylinder clock on the wave-carved marble mantel chimed 4 times for the 2nd hour of the morning.
"With a few days' warning, I could have laid on something magnificent."
"I don't want anything magnificent," Matt told him. He did not want anything from the man, but by chance Beslin had seen Tom slipping into the stable yard of the wandering woman a little earlier.
Tom had gone to keep Jolene amused until Eginan brought her Suldam that evening, to settle her nerves and jolly her along with courtly manners. But there could have been any number of reasons for him to visit the inn. Well, maybe not that many, with it full of Seanchan, but several, surely. Only Beslin had leaped to the reason like a duck leaping on a beetle, and he refused to be left out. "It will be enough if a few of your friends fire some of the stores the Seanchan have stockpiled on the Bay Road. After midnight, mind. As near as they can reckon it. Better an hour later than any time before." With any luck, he would be out of the city before midnight. "That will draw their attention away south, and you know losing stores will hurt them."
"I said I would do it," Beslin said sourly. "But you can't say setting fires is exactly a grand gesture."
Sitting back, Matt rested his hands on the bamboo-carved arms of the chair and frowned. He wanted to rest his hands anyway, but his signet ring made a metallic clicking on the gilded wood as he tapped his fingers.
"Beslin, you will be seen at the inn when those fires are set, won't you?"
The other man grimaced.
"Beslin?"
Beslin flung up his hands.
"I know, I know. I mustn't endanger Mother. I'll be seen. By midnight, I'll be as drunk as an innkeeper's husband. You can wager I'll be seen. It just isn't very heroic, Matt. I'm at war with the Seanchan whether or not Mother is."
Matt tried not to sigh. He almost succeeded. There was no way to hide the 3 Red Arms moving horses out of the stables, of course. Twice that morning, he noticed serving women handing coins to others, and both times the woman doing the handing over glared when she saw him. Even with Vannon and Harnan apparently still solidly ensconced in the long barracks room near the stables, the palace knew that Matt Cawthon was leaving soon, and wagers were being paid already. He just had to make sure no one found out how soon before it was too late. The wind picked up strength as the morning wore on, but he had Pips saddled and rode his endless circles in the palace stable yard, huddling a little in his saddle and clutching his cloak close. He rode more slowly than usual, so Pips's steel shoes made a lazy plodding sound on the paving stones. Now and then, he grimaced at the darkening clouds in the sky and shook his head. No, Matt Cawthon did not like being out in this weather, Matt Cawthon would be staying somewhere warm and dry until the skies cleared. Yes, he would. The Suldam walking Damani in their own circle in the stable yard knew he was leaving soon, too. Maybe the serving women did not talk directly to the Shan Chan women, but what one woman knew was always known to every woman inside a mile soon enough. Wildfire did not run through dry woods as fast as gossip ran through women. A tall, yellow-haired Suldam glanced in his direction and shook her head. A short, stout Suldam laughed out loud, splitting a face as dark as any of the sea folk. He was just Thailand's toy. The Suldam did not concern him, but Teslin did. For several days, until this morning, he had not seen her among the Damani being exercised. Today the Suldam let their cloaks fly with the wind, but the Damani all held theirs tightly around them, except Teslin's gray cloak flapped this way and that, forgotten, and she stumbled a little where the pavement was uneven. Her eyes were wide and worried in that Aes Sedai face. Occasionally she darted a glance at the buxom, black-haired Suldam wearing the other end of her silver leash, and when she did, she licked her lips uncertainly. A tightness settled in Matt's belly. Where had the determination gone? If she was ready to knuckle under.
"Everything all right?" Vannin said when Matt dismounted and gave him Pips's reins.
Rain had begun to fall, cold, fat drops, and the Suldam were hurrying their charges inside, laughing and running to avoid getting wet. Some of the Damani were laughing, too, a sound to chill Matt's blood. Vannin took no chances anyone might wonder why they were standing in the rain to talk. The fat man bent to lift Pips's left foreleg and study the hoof.
"You look a mite more peaked than usual."
"Everything is just fine," Matt told him. The ache in his leg and hip gnawed like a tooth, but he was barely aware of it, or of the quickening rain. Light if Teslin was cracking now. "Just remember, if you hear shouting inside the palace tonight, or anything that sounds like trouble, you and Harnan don't wait. You ride out right then and go find Ulver. He'll be..."
"I know where the little tyke'll be."
Letting go of Pips's leg and straightening, Vannin spat through one of the gaps in his teeth. Raindrops ran down his face.
"Harnan ain't too stupid to put his boots on alone, and I know what to do. You just take care of your piece of it, and make sure your luck is working. Come on there, boy,"
he added much more warmly to Pips.
"I got some good oats for you, and a fine hot fish stew for me."
Matt knew he should eat too, but he felt as though he had swallowed a stone, and it did not leave room for food. Hobbling back up to Thailand's apartments, he threw his damp cloak over a chair, and for a time stood staring at the corner where his black-hafted spear stood propped next to his unstrung bow. He planned to come back for the Ashandarai at the last moment. The blood should all be abed by the time he moved, and the servants as well, with only the guards outside remaining awake. But he would not risk being seen with it before he had to. Even the Shan Chan who called him Toy would take notice of him carrying a weapon through the halls in the middle of the night. He had meant to carry the bow, too. Good black yew was almost impossible to find outside the Two Rivers, and they cut it too short besides. Unstrung, a bow should be two hands taller than the man who would draw it. Maybe he should abandon it after all, though. He would need both hands to use the Ashandarai if it came to that, and the moment needed to drop the bow might be the moment that killed him.
"Everything will go according to plan," he said aloud. Blood and ashes, he sounded as wool-headed as Beslan. "I'm not going to have to fight my way out of the bloody palace."
And almost as fool-witted. Luck was a very fine thing with the dice. Depending on luck other places could get a man dead. Lying down on the bed, he propped one booted foot atop the other and lay studying the bow and the spear. With the door to the sitting room open, he could hear the cylinder clock softly chime each hour away. Light, he needed his luck tonight. The window light faded so slowly, he almost got up to see whether the sun had stopped, but eventually gray light faded to purple twilight, then to full dark. The clock chimed twice, and then the only sounds were the drumming of the rain and the rush of the wind. Workmen who had been braving the weather would be downing tools to trudge home. No one came to light the lamps or tend the fires. No one expected him to be there, since he had slept in the bed the night before. The flames in the bedroom fireplace dwindled and died. Everything was in motion now. Olver was snug in that old stable. It still had most of its roof. The clock sounded the first full hour of the night, and after no more than a week, four chimes for the second. Rising from the bed, he felt his way into the pitch-dark sitting room and pulled open the hinged casement of one of the tall windows. The strong wind drove raindrops through the intricate white wrought-iron screen, quickly soaking his coat. The moon was hidden behind clouds, and the city was a mass of rain-shrouded darkness without even lightning to break it. All the street lamps had apparently been extinguished by the rain and wind. The night would hide them when they left the palace. And any patrol that sought them out in this weather would look twice. Shivering as the wind cut through his damp coat, he shut the casement. Taking a seat on the edge of one of the bamboo-carved chairs, he propped his elbows on his knees and watched the clock above the dead fireplace. He could not see it in the darkness, but here he could hear the steady tick. He remained motionless, though. The single chime of another hour made him twitch. There was nothing now but to wait. In a little while, Aginin would be introducing Jolene to her Suldam. If she really had been able to find three who would do as she claimed. If Jolene did not panic when they first put the Idam on her. Tom, Jolene, and the others from the inn would meet him just before he reached the Dal Ira. And if he did not reach it, Tom had gone ahead with carving his turnip. He was sure he could get them past the gates with his forged order. At least they had a chance if it all fell apart. If. Too many ifs to think about now. It was too late for that. Ding from the clock, like a piece of crystal tapped with a spoon. Ding. About now, Julin would be making his way to his precious Thera, and with any luck, Beslin was starting to drink hard at an inn somewhere. Drawing a deep breath, he stood in the blackness and checked his knives by feel, up his sleeves, beneath his coat, tucked into the turned-down tops of his boots, one hanging down inside the back of his collar. That done, he left the apartments. Too late for anything but beginning. The empty hallways he walked along were only dimly lit. One stand lamp in three or four carried flames in front of the mirrors, little pools of light with pale shadows between that never quite reached darkness. His boots were loud on the floor tiles. They rang on the marble stairs. It was unlikely anyone at all would be awake this late, but if someone did see him, he must not look as if he were skulking. Tucking his thumbs behind his belt, he made himself saunter. It was no worse than stealing a pie from a kitchen windowsill. Though, come to think of it, the spotty memories that remained of his boyhood seemed to contain getting half-skinned for that a time or two. Stepping onto the columned walk that bordered the stable yard, he turned up his collar against the wind-driven rain flying between the fluted white columns. Bloody rain. A man could drown in it, even when he had not really been outside yet. The wall-mounted lamps had blown out, except for the pair flanking the open gates, the only glowing spots in the pouring rain. He could not make out the guards outside the gates. The Seanchan squad would be as motionless as if it were a pleasant afternoon. Very likely the Ebu Dari, too. They did not like being shown up in any way. After a moment, he retreated to the anteroom door to avoid getting completely drenched. Nothing moved in the stable yard. Where were they? Blood and bloody ashes, where? Riders appeared in the gates, led by two men afoot carrying pole lanterns. He could not count them in the rain, but they were too many. Would Seanchan messengers have lantern bearers? Maybe, in this weather. Grimacing, he took another step back into the anteroom. The thin light of a single stand lamp behind him was enough to turn the night outside to a blanket of black, but he peered into it. In a few minutes, four heavily cloaked figures appeared, hurrying toward the door. If they were messengers, they would pass him by without a second glance. "Your man Vannon is rude," Eginen announced, throwing back her hood as soon as she was beyond the fluted columns. In the darkness, her face was just a shadow, but the coldness of her voice was sufficient to tell him what he would see before she stepped into the anteroom, forcing him to move back. Her brows were drawn down sharply, and her blue eyes were icy augurs. A grim-faced doman followed her, shaking rein from his cloak, and then a pair of Suldam, one pale and yellow-haired, the other with long brown hair. He could not see much more, since they stood with their heads down, studying the floor tiles in front of their feet.
"You didn't tell me she had two men with her," Eginen went on, peeling her gloves off.
Odd how she could make that drawl sound brisk. She did not give a man room to squeeze in a word.
"Or that Mistress Annan was coming. Luckily, I know how to adapt. Plans always need adapting once the anchor is dry. Speaking of dry, have you been running around outside already? I trust you haven't gotten yourself noticed."
"What do you mean, you adapted the plan?" Matt demanded, raking his hands through his hair. Light, it was wet.
"I had everything laid out."
Why were those two Suldam standing so still? If he had ever seen statues of reluctance, it was that pair. "Who are those others out there?"
"The people from the inn," Eginen said impatiently. "For one thing, I need a proper entourage to look right for any street patrols. Those two warders are muscular fellows. They make excellent lantern bearers. For another, I didn't want to risk missing them in this blow. Better that we are all together from the start."
Her head turned, following his glances at the Suldam.
"These are Sita Zarbi and Rena Imain. I suspect they hope you'll forget those names after tonight."
The pale woman flinched at the name Sita, which made the other Rena. Neither raised her head. What hold did Eginen have on them anyway? Not that it mattered. All that mattered was that they were here and ready to do what was necessary.
"No point standing here," Matt said. "Let's get on with it."
He let her changes in the plan go without further comment. After all, lying on that bed in Thailand's apartments, he had decided to risk a change or two himself.